Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Good morning. Today is the day. It is Wednesday, the 17th of July. I'm going to talk about that date and what it means in my life in just a second. But I want to actually begin where the news ended there at the top of the hour. The defunding of Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers across the country has begun. The new HHS rule prohibits Title X funds. Those are our tax dollars. From being used to, quote, perform, promote, refer for, or support abortion as a method of family planning, end quote. So it also requires Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers to financially and physically separate their abortion services from their non-abortion services. For most Planned Parenthood clinics, that is going to mean they actually have to have two different facilities operating, one where they do what the government recognizes as family planning and another where they provide abortions and abortion consultative services. So you might imagine that that's going to be very costly. Planned Parenthood initially said it was not going to follow the new rule. Well, Planned Parenthood has now announced that it's going to pull money from an emergency fund to make up for the shortage. Here's the quote from Planned Parenthood's president, Leanna Wen, which for those of you who are following the news also know, she's now out. So here was the quote yesterday. While we are incredibly concerned by this harmful rule, our doors are still open. Well, Leanna Wen is now, as of yesterday, out as the president of Planned Parenthood. No doubt these stories are related. When you fail to do what is ultimately a political job, even if people are calling what you're doing healthcare, if what you fail at is the politics of your job, which in this case would have meant Planned Parenthood would have continued to secure $60 million, these particular $60 million in federal funding. They have a lot of other federal funding, but this is $60 million is a big chunk. when you fail in a political job, this is generally the outcome. So she is out as the president of Planned Parenthood less than a year into her tenure in that post. So we will see what happens there. In the meantime, let's pray for pro-life people across the country to be genuinely pro-life, not only for the preborn, but for those who are already here in the world, that we would promote lives of flourishing, that children would have safe homes in which to grow up and be cared for, and that their moms would be cared for, and on and on and on. If we're going to be pro-life, let's be genuinely pro-life, not just for the preborn, but for those who are living among us even now. The House of Representatives was an absolute chaotic mess last night. We are not going to dig into that specifically this morning during this program, but I promise you that we will. If you get to the place where those who are supposed to be governing us do not follow the rules, which is basically what happened last night. Once you get to the place where the person who is supposed to be enforcing the rules, in this case, Nancy Pelosi, once you get to the place where that individual is willing to break the rules along partisan lines, we have a real, so I used to be a Presbyterian. And so Presbyterians actually crafted this form of government. I hate to just put it all on the shoulders of one group of people, but, you know, that lots of the conceptions of how the government works were actually conceived of by Presbyterians. And so watching the fracture and failure of the Presbyterian denomination, particularly the PCUSA, was a pretty good forecast of what was going to happen nationally. And unfortunately, that does not bode well, because once you start undermining your own foundations of the way you have mutually agreed things are going to be discussed and decided upon, once you undermine your own foundations, you end up unable to then use those systems to actually manage things. And so that's, you know, unfortunately what I think we are beginning to see, well, or seeing the effects of in the House of Representatives. So let's just be praying today for those who are serving us in positions of elected leadership, and let's Let's hope they find their footing again. Hey, next up is Drew Griffin. He and I are going to talk about some things happening globally. He is with Providence Magazine, and he's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Welcoming again, Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. Drew, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Carmen. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I'm in Washington, D.C., observing the circus. So,
well, which part of the circus are you observing? Because I guess I'm hoping you are observing the international religious freedom conversation.
I have been observing that. Yeah, there are many tents in this circus. There are many different stages that you can go and you can kind of observe what's going on. But yes, yeah, I'm focused this week on some discussions about conservatism, but then also international religious freedom.
I love that. Okay, so the State Department has a new commission on unalienable rights. We started a conversation about this last week. Really just roaming around in what is an unalienable right and how do we, you know, sort of get our hearts and minds around that concept. But there's lots of concerns and some recommendations related to this. Could you share those with us?
Sure. Yeah. This is a new position that's created, a new commission that's been created within the State Department. It's part of, I think, the Trump administration's desire to kind of delineate their efforts and create some difference and some space on the efforts of the State Department from that of his predecessor, Barack Obama, to specify and make as specific as possible their efforts to protect religious minorities abroad, specifically Christians. Christians are, I think, the main focus of the Office of International Religious Freedom. And then now this new creation of a new commission of the Commission of Unalienable Rights. And it has drawn a little bit of criticism in that it seems a little bit redundant of like, you know, we already have commissions on, you know, freedoms and commissions on rights and human rights and international religious freedom. Unalienable rights seems a little bit obscure. It seems a little bit open. It's being chaired. The chair of the commission has been appointed as a former Vatican ambassador, Marianne Glendon, who is currently at Harvard. And so there's, it hasn't really done anything yet. It hasn't. It literally was created 3 weeks ago. So there's very little kind of to critique. But there are some concerns in that it's so vague and kind of just so open to interpretation that it's hard to know exactly what it is that they are going to defend. I mean, rights are funny things. They often tell us what we have access to or should have access to, but not necessarily what we should do about it or what we should do about the rights that we have and when those rights are being impinged upon by others. And so it's an interesting time. I'm grateful. I'm kind of loath and hesitant to offer praise in this kind of current political moment sometimes. But I am grateful for the State Department, for Secretary Pompeo, and for the effort that they are making. I think to draw attention to the denial of rights by so many countries. Of our kind of brothers and sisters, other Christians, and their outright persecution, and to try and flesh out, I think, an apparatus to articulate the freedoms and liberties that not only should be available and enjoyed, you know, by people in other political systems and other governments, but that are somewhat inalienable, that there's a certain level of soul freedom and there's a certain level of freedom of conscience that should be extended to every person who bears the image of God. And helping to articulate that in a way that is that's clear and maybe different than the way that the world maybe has done it through the United Nations Council on Human Rights is, I think, a helpful thing. So I'm actually grateful for it.
So I like the way that if people go to providencemag.com, there you guys have an article posted on this. And I like the way that it's articulated at the very end of that article, this notion. I think that the challenge that we have in the conversation today is that we recognize some, we immediately recognize some rights as inalienable or unalienable. And yet here in the United States, our perspective has, I would say, morphed and grown. And to the list of what we see as unalienable rights, we are beginning in our culture to add what might be called economic or social rights. And I like the way that you that in this piece, I know that you didn't write it, Paul Marshall wrote it, but it's excellent and it's posted at providencemag.com. I like the way that he distinguishes what might be aspirational economic and social rights, that might be aspirational goals that might be set for a culture or a country, versus unalienable rights, which should be not only have universal application and be achievable, but be able to be immediately defended in every culture. And certainly the conversation in our culture, let's say about maybe healthcare being a universal right or abortion being a universal right, like those are not unalienable rights. Those are maybe for particular cultures aspirational, and maybe for some people in our culture viewed as something that everyone should have access to, but that's not necessarily universal. It's not global, and they're not unalienable. Is that a good distinction?
No, I think it's a great distinction. I mean, part of the American experiment is that it's, you know, America kind of exists to expand upon these basic and kind of fundamental rights. They expand the enjoyment of them, to expand their application across culture. You know, when the country started, Thomas Jefferson is writing down the Declaration, yeah, that we're all endowed with certain inalienable rights. And yet, you know, there is all men are created equal. And yet, you know, he owned slaves and women didn't have a vote. And so America has been this long and oftentimes bloody and difficult and contentious fight to expand on the application of those rights. The thing that's kind of the catch 22 about liberal democracy and that kind of expansion is that sometimes we don't know where to stop. Right. I mean, it's in our very nature and blood to kind of continue to expand and reinterpret and find new ground, a new area in which to apply the enjoyment of these rights. But where the moment in which we find ourselves now is that to your point and to Paul's point on providencemag.com is that it's a where do you stop, where do you begin to draw the line? And I think he makes a very important historical distinction that I think Marianne Glendon would be, you know, well to take into advisement of, just that, you know, there are historical realities and definitions of some of these terms that are very helpful and that I think it would be wise for us to return to. And I think we need to avoid some of the mission creep that we see in the current environment when we talk about rights. I think, though, that if I had to guess, Secretary Pompeo and the Trump administration, based off of everything else that they have done, are making an effort to kind of separate themselves out from the kind of the world community. You know, we left the United Nations Human Rights Commission last year, mainly because of their kind of inconsistent application of their own charter and their own kind of mandates in regards to Israel and other countries. And so I think the United States is trying to become more specific and trying to kind of go back to the beginning. And that to me is, you know, a good thing. There's a lot of potential there.
Hey, Drew, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about some countries where there are some really serious abuses of these kinds of rights. Let's talk about China, the challenge that Iraqi Christians continue to face, and the ongoing agony of the Yazidis. I'm hoping that we can grab all of those subjects pretty quickly upon our return. We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking with Drew Griffin. You can follow him online at DG_NYC.
Oh, church, arise and put your armor on. Hear the call of Christ our captain.
Continuing my conversation with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. You can find it at providencemag.com. Let's hit three topics really quickly, Drew. First of all, China has been rebuked by 22 nations. Tell us what's going on there.
So members of 22 different countries issued a statement to the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights and kind of an open letter decrying Chinese treatments of minorities, the Uyghurs that we've talked about before on this program, which are a kind of a Muslim minority in the western province of Xinjiang. There are literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions now, of Uyghurs that have been placed into re-education camps, detention camps. Honestly, if you want to talk about what is a concentration camp, this would be a far more kind of accurate description of what a concentration camp might be. These Uyghurs have been brought in, and they are pressed, and they are kind of brainwashed and threatened and told to basically pledge loyalty to the state. And China has also faced criticism and treatment about their Christian minority as well, burning Bibles and shutting down churches and bulldozing churches down and imprisoning pastors. And so 22 countries issued a statement to the commission. The United States did not take part in that open letter. But again, the United States has been critical and has often led the criticism of China, where even in the Middle East, a lot of Middle Eastern countries that are majority Muslim have been kind of loath to do so. So it's a tragic situation. And definitely deserves a prayer and attention and criticism.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. And then we have talked at length over time about the plight of the Iraqi Christians. I think we've been hoping that they would have the opportunity to be returning to their homeland. Tell us what's going on there.
So Christians have been in Iraq since really apostolic times. I mean, since basically the Acts, you know, the Book of Acts. I mean, there have been Christians in the area of Iraq, in the area kind of between the rivers, and leading up into the kind of the Iraq War in 2003, there were literally hundreds of thousands of Christians that existed in Iraq following the war and kind of the breakdown of society there. You know, hundreds of thousands of those Christians fled up into the Nineveh Plain in order to seek some kind of safety as the Sunnis and Shias, Muslims and the cities and urban areas began to kind of fight it out. And they sought comfort and safety in the Nineveh Plain. But then as we saw with the rise of ISIS, right, to the Islamic State in the Levant, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as they began to establish a geographic caliphate, they, you know, pushed into the Nineveh Plain and drove out probably close to 120,000 Christians out of their homes. And you have now that ISIS has been defeated, you have maybe half of those, around 60,000, that have returned back into their churches, back into their towns in the northern part of Iraq. But unfortunately, ISIS still exists in kind of nascent form. It's underground and it's still quite dangerous. They're burning fields and destroying crops and harassing pastors and still committed to kind of the eradication of any other religious presence other than that of Islam in the region. And so Christians are still facing immense persecution. And this is what an area that's very much their ancient homeland. So it's in no way, even though ISIS has been technically defeated in terms of its kind of geopolitical presence and its geographic power, it is still very much a threat to Christians in Iraq.
And then certainly in relationship to the Yazidis, we remember that one of the tactics used by ISIS when they overtook the Yazidi people in their ancestral Iraqi home of Sinjar in 2014 is that they used systematic rape, and they sold and they married off young Yazidi women who subsequently had children while they were in captivity. Tell us what is now happening with those children who were born in these forced unions.
Well, it is now a horrible circumstance where you have children who have, you know, ISIS fathers that have either been killed or imprisoned or are still alive. You have a torn allegiance. I mean, as far as strategies go, you know, entering in kind of to a genetic population is probably not a bad strategy if your goal is to kind of wipe out that population and win that kind of population over. So it's the consequences of it, though, are it's ripping families apart. It's ripping children away from their mothers, and it's an immense kind of political difficulty in this kind of marriage of horrible techniques of rape, and so it's a it's tragic. I mean, it's truly definitely, I think, probably one of the worst tragedies in the Middle East that we can identify.
Yeah, I think there's a real opportunity here for, for a Christian witness in terms of where these children end up. So, hey, Drew Griffin, we're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us. You guys can find Drew, DG_NYC, on Twitter. You can also find him at providencemag.com. Drew, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Carmen.
So I'm wondering today, when we're having the conversation about unalienable rights, and we talk about, you know, the inherent equality of all people and the inherent equality certainly then of men and women, the conversation about equality sometimes then morphs into a conversation about we are all actually the same and there's no differences among us. And that's actually not true. And so next up, I want to have a conversation with Peter Kapsner about the intolerance of the supposedly ultra tolerant, and how this conversation has really come full circle. So just consider for a moment that you are a girl and you are playing competitive sports and you have your chosen, you know, your chosen sport that you excel in. And then a biological male who cannot compete against biological men and win comes and competes against women and wins in a women's sports category. Is that fair? Is that equality being extended to someone who chooses to identify as trans? And is that happening to the detriment of women? And is that fair? All right, so that conversation up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
There never seems to be enough time to get my to-do list done. It grows faster than I can cross things off of it. Hi, this is Callie Breeze with Thrivent, helping you be wise and thrive. Maybe you're like me, literally running late, trying to get dinner fixed on time, or rushing to the store for the eggs you forgot. It's easy to be consumed by the stuff we have to do, stuff that takes our time. But have you ever thought of time as a gift, something for you to steward? Think about how you can use your time to live out your faith. Maybe it's listening to a friend who needs to talk through a problem, or giving your time at church. Even just being intentional about the time you spend with your spouse or your kids is a gift. You know, God gives each of us an allotment of time on earth. The way we manage that time is a form of stewardship. Are you using your time to be a blessing to others? When you do, you'll find you live a more content life.
Living life upside down. This is an excellent way to approach the conversation with Peter Kapsner. He and I like to talk about the 50 shades of truth in the culture today. What is upside down and inside out? Peter Kapsner, welcome back.
Thanks, Carmen. Great to hear your voice again, as always.
Well, it's great to talk with you. So let me start with women's soccer, and then I would like to move to weightlifting. So in the women's soccer category, this is actually a conversation between two women. So our next conversation about weightlifting is going to introduce the concept of men competing in women's sports. But I want to start with this very high profile conversation in the culture related to U.S. women's soccer team. And this is a headline that I found pretty staggering, I guess, is my way to say it. So these are teammates, one who is a Christian, one who is now accusing the person who is a Christian of basically being homophobic. And so I want to unpack a little bit of that word And I want to unpack a little bit of what's going on here. So, you know, tell us what you know.
Yeah, boy, this is an interesting situation, isn't it? And I should just add a few caveats here. And it's maybe not the most popular take, but I have to admit that I was not a fan of this particular version of the women's soccer team in the United States. And I've cheered for them heavily in the past. And certainly was nothing about men's or women's sports. I also didn't like the Miami Heat when LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh all sort of got together. And the reason for that, Carmen, is I felt like it was a very ego-driven sort of team. It was a self-congratulatory sort of team. It was all about oneself. And pretty much anybody that stood in their way was going to be seen as a villain in terms of their agenda and their thought and what they wanted to accomplish. And I always have a hard time with that particular approach. I think that anytime that somebody is doing a power over move like that, male, female, doesn't really matter at all. It is antithetical to kingdom life. So I love our country. That was not an anti-American statement. I just had a hard time cheering for this particular version of it. And it showed up in this story a bit, too, where there was, as you mentioned, one of the former teammates who said that she really didn't want to play for the U.S. women's soccer team because of some of the gay and lesbian lifestyle that's involved in women's soccer. And boy, she was really ripped to shreds by some members of the existing team because of her stance. And this is a team, Carmen, that will promote tolerance on every level. We'll talk about how important words like inclusion might be. But as you and I have chatted about in the past, we know that inclusion really only means, in this particular kind of situation, those people who agree with whatever platform it is that happens to be promoted, in this case, LGBTQ issues. And so if you do have a problem or you do have a different point of view, inclusion doesn't include all points of view. It's really a word that maybe we need a different word to describe it, because it doesn't include those who would disagree with them. And that's what we saw in this instance. But that's what we see in the broader culture, too, whether it be in university settings or in church settings or in business settings. It doesn't really matter. If you embrace the word inclusion, what you tend not to include is anybody who might have a different take than you do on a given situation.
So I thought that the numbers and the breakdown of this conversation were pretty interesting. They highlight two high-profile players on the women's team who are Christians, Julie Ertz and Tobin Heath. And they note that there are several players who would kneel in prayer circles. That's not necessarily, acknowledging that they're Christians, but that they kneel in prayer circles before or after each of the World Cup contests. However, this next sentence I found pretty staggering. I was surprised at these numbers. There are five openly gay players on Team USA, in addition to coach Jill Ellis. And in the 2019 Women's World Cup, 40 out gay, lesbian, and bisexual women, 38 players, one coach, and one trainer. I think that when we talk about women's sports today, this is an interesting part of the conversation, and I think it's a conversation that we have to have as Christians with our girls who are competing. They are going to be competing in a field of play where there is a dominant worldview that is not necessarily shared by those of us from a more traditional Christian worldview. So I just think that it's important it's important to prepare our kids for those conversations. The other conversation for girls playing sports that we have to now prepare them for is that they may be competing against men. Tell us what's going on here when it comes to weightlifting.
Yeah, we saw a weightlifter who had transitioned from male to female, obviously won a pretty substantial competition, and that doesn't necessarily cause too much of a ripple into the sports headlines or even into the news headlines because it's weightlifting. But Carmen, I was thinking about it last night as kind of going through the news and as you and I and Paul were chatting about some of these things, is that let's just change the scenario. Let's take this idea to its logical conclusion, because that's how you always test ideas, and you test the merits of ideas by taking them to all of the different areas in which they might go. And so let's relate it back to the soccer conversation. Let's say that 11 men wanted to get together and they were very, very good soccer players, maybe elite level soccer players. And let's say that the women's team did accomplish so much of what I think is an important conversation about equal pay and equal opportunity. And the women were starting to get to be paid, let's say, $2 million, $4 million, $6 million a year instead of the couple hundred thousand dollars a year that they're getting paid right now. And if 11 men wanted to go ahead and transition to become women and try out for the soccer team, that would really test the inclusion policy, would it not? I would think on every possible level, if it wasn't just a male transitioning to a female to win a weightlifting competition, that at the end of the day, not many people really follow much of that. But in testing the scenario to its logical conclusion, you have to take it to that place. You have to say, what if this was a very high visibility situation, where, as I said, 11 men went ahead and transitioned to try to take advantage of the $2, 3, 4, or 5 million annually that they could win in so doing. And I think that's where we're ultimately going to see this entire sort of philosophy of life begin to break down, is when money and finance gets involved and there is a lucrative opportunity to change your gender. I think at that point, we're going to see some of the tension that already exists really begin to explode.
All right. And for those of us who are Christians, you know, I think we need to be prepared and equipped to have the conversation, you know, about the reality that men and women, although equal, are different, and
right,
that there are real differences, and that those differences are persistent, even if, you know, even if I identify as something other than what I truly am. All right. So we're going to come back from the break and talk about Scarlett Johansson. This is a you know, a provocative conversation happening in Hollywood about art and about the art of acting. And we're going to talk about identity. So that conversation is up next here with Peter Kapsner.
There's never been a moment I was not held beside your arms. And there's never been a day when you were not who you say you are.
All right, continuing my conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner, he and I like to talk about the headline news as it relates to identity conversations in the culture, so that you can be equipped to walk into the conversations of the day as a Christian with, you know, things sorted out in ways that align with kingdom principles, as opposed to the way the world tends to sort things out, which are often not kingdom aligned. Well, not kingdom of God aligned. So, Peter, we have Scarlett Johansson. She is obviously an A-list actress. She made the headlines a while back for giving up a role where she was cast to play a transgender character, and she gave that role up, you know, sort of as an act of political correctness, because she was getting a lot of heat because that role, it was argued, should go to a person who was not white nor cisgender, which Scarlett Johansson happens to be. And so in a more recent article or conversation, she is it sort of alleged that that she backtracked, or, well, not backtracked, that she sort of said, hey, that's just all political correctness. And that's really, you know, I should be allowed to play anything or anyone. And there's a question as to whether or not this interview is actually about that. But I would love to have this conversation about political correctness in casting, and what is acting? What is art and what is acting? That might be a more interesting conversation for us to have.
Well, sure. It really was kind of a interesting scenario for, as you mentioned, an A-list actress like this. And for listeners, you'd probably know her as Black Widow from the Avengers series. And she was going to play, as you mentioned, a transgender male in a movie, Rub and Tub, is due to be released. And she did back down from the role because of some pretty aggressive energy from the left. I would have thought she would have maybe backed down, Carmen, because of a situation maybe where there's a lot of protesting going on by the religious right or something like that. But in this case, it came from her left. And she is a person who would absolutely be supportive of the LGBTQ conversation and community. There's nothing in her history that would suggest anything other than. But she really did experience the backlash, as you said, that somebody has to play a role that they already are sort of in regular life. So it should have been a transgender person who played this role, not Scarlett Johansson. And on one level, you know, her response was, as an actor, I should be allowed to play any person or any tree or any animal, because that's my job and the requirements of my job. And that's always been true of any art. I mean, you go back to early Greek theater and Roman tragedies and all of the different ways in which theater is presented. Of course, men would be playing transgender women or back and forth. That was just part of the deal. It's always been part of art. So it was pretty interesting to see what the response was in terms of the energy against her in this particular situation.
Did you ever play a tree in what's the most unusual role you've ever played in some sort of acting gig?
So understanding that I might be the worst theater performer that has ever existed, I believe I was an angel in the heavenly choir in the Noah story of all things. And when I look back at the text, Carmen, I don't know any kind of angelic choir in the Noah story, but that's as far as I got in my acting role was being an angel.
Yeah. So my last acting role was in fifth grade, and Miss Mabry. Was the casting, she was our teacher, so she was also obviously the person who chose who played what role. And so who was Tom Sawyer's aunt?
Does anybody?
I played her. Like I played the, right? So which would be like the bossy person, I think, in the Tom Sawyer story. And then maybe not surprisingly, when it came around to Alice in Wonderland, who do you imagine that I played?
Well, did you play the Queen of Hearts?
I did. Yes. Off with their heads. Yes, exactly.
I
so
believe that.
I think that in fifth grade, I was already who I am and I was not acting. I mean, there you go. I was playing the roles so it was typecasting. Okay. So, I would just love to encourage people who are Christians, who are in the art and entertainment industries today, speak to them, speak to their hearts and speak to the beauty that, you know, we are called to bring into what our craft. Whatever it is.
Right. Well, and I think, Carmen, that's really the most important piece of this puzzle is that we obviously are going to disagree with supporting transgender rights and the movement there. But in so doing, we have to be really careful that in this particular situation that we support the arts. And I think as Christians, sometimes we are victims of what's called iconoclasm, which is the idea of the removal of all art and all images and all visual representations of our faith because we're afraid that they may end up being worshipped. And I understand that on some level, but art really draws out the human soul in some ways that strict theology just simply cannot. And I don't think it's meant to be taken out of the Christian journey. I know I am deeply, deeply moved when maybe I go see Les Miserables, for example, and the character of Jean Valjean representing this incredible transformative move from a person who was hardened against God to a person who was very much a person of grace and submission to God. And seeing that depicted in art moves my heart and causes me to love God far more deeply than maybe just a theological lecture ever might. And so I think to celebrate art with our kids, to celebrate music with our kids, to recognize that there's like any field we get into, there's going to be resistance, there's going to be a bit of craziness. In this particular situation, the political correctness seeking to shut down everything that doesn't absolutely agree with them is tricky. But I think we need to embrace art as a way of life and faith and dance and all of these things because we see them all in the scriptures, and boy, it really does represent our faith in some ways that you and I just simply can't, even in doing a radio show.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and tell our producer, Paul Perreault, that we're going to run through the break because I want us to spend a couple of minutes talking about this article related to, well, we're calling it an IVF embryo mix-up, but what in reality has happened is that people have so commodified babies that they think that they should get the baby that they order. And so there's a story about a couple who ordered a particular kind of baby, and that's not the baby that was born. And so this goes beyond just human error. I think this goes into a conversation about, you know, well, about all kinds of things. So you as the ethics and religion person, what do you see here?
Yeah, this is one of the this falls into the category for me, Carmen, of what is just a really difficult and murky situation. When we cover this particular topic in my ethics class, and I just got done doing this 2 months ago or so, there was a pastor in our class that had a couple children that had been produced through in vitro fertilization and beautiful, lovely kids. But he talked about even just the wrestling match of how much money was dedicated to it. But more importantly, and this is really the nub of the issue with in vitro fertilization, is that in his case, I think they created 8 to 10 embryos, and then they implant maybe 2 to 3 to 4 to try to get a high degree of success. But the remaining 6 are left sort of in this frozen, suspended state of animation in an embryo bank just outside the city of Atlanta, I believe, where there's literally tens of thousands of embryos waiting to be implanted. And so I think this is where it gets hard because you celebrate the life that's involved. And I'm sure there are many, many, many people listening that have their own children that are of in vitro fertilization or nieces and nephews that the technology has helped just create these beautiful souls. But you see the rippling effect of it as well in terms of, so what do you do with the remaining children? Or in the case of this story, what happens when, as this mother was understandably very worried and confused and hurt that she didn't have a chance to bond with her own child in her womb because they had mixed it up on the medical technology standpoint of it. And so the issues, Carmen, really are is at what level do we play God in terms of medicine? And that would be a much bigger conversation for you and me maybe some other time. I mean, how much is taking an ibuprofen, you know, is that playing God? But that obviously falls in a different category. This is just so entirely troubling when we take matters into our own hands. And I think there's a lot of different angles we need to look at in terms of medical ethics. We need to look at why are we pursuing such technologies? Is it about our own happiness? And are there other ways to think about it? And yet I celebrate the children that are birthed from it. So I honestly, out of about maybe 100 different ethics conversations we have in 14 weeks in class, this falls in the top three of the most difficult ones.
Well, and part of this conversation is about, you know, them ordering, you know, two girls. And obviously they became concerned when one of the embryos was a boy. Like, that's where this right. conversation starts. And so, I mean, I think that we as Christians have got to enter into these conversations, and we've got to start talking about the commodification of children and the separation of, you know, of kids from marriage and parenting. Yep. And so this is a conversation you and I'll have to return to again. All right. I have blown through the break. This has been Peter Kapsner with 50 Shades of Truth on Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. All right. So that is 1 hour this morning in the books, and we have another hour ahead. Bill English will be back from BibleandBusiness.com. He and I are going to continue our conversation about the leadership lessons we learned from King David. And then Scott McKnight will be here. We're going to read Romans backwards. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.